You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Volume 2, The National Socialist Movement. To understand this more easily, it is useful for us to look back at the real origins of human cultural development. The first step man took that visibly removed him from the animals was his ability to invent. The very first invention was the discovery of tricks and strategies that were used to make the fight for life easier against other creatures, and sometimes were the sole reason a struggle had a favorable outcome for man. These primitive inventions do not reveal the character of their creators, because these inventions or strategies are only seen by present-day man, and then only as a mass phenomenon, a collection of hunting methods and defensive actions spanning a long period. There are also certain tricks and shrewd precautions that can be observed in animals. Man is unable to determine or explore the origins of these actions, so he simply resorts to describing these actions as instinctive. In the present case, this word means nothing. Anyone who believes in a higher development of living creatures must admit that every impulse and every act in their battle for life must have had a beginning at some time. One individual must have done it first, then it was repeated, then others repeated it more widely, until at last it became part of the subconscious of all the members of a given species and appeared as an instinct. This is easier to understand and easier to believe in the case of man. Man's first clever steps in the battle to control other animals must surely have been made by members of his own civilization who were particularly gifted. Even here, character was once the absolute source for good decisions and conduct that were later adopted by all mankind until they were finally taken for granted. In the same way, all common military strategy originated in one particular mind, and then it spread and came to be generally taken for granted after many years. Sometimes it may have taken hundreds of years to become widespread. Man supplements his first invention by a second invention. He learns to use other things. He puts objects and even living creatures to work in the struggle to preserve his own existence. This is where the inventive nature of man, as we see it everywhere around us today, begins. We can see from these material inventions that character is a component in such creations more and more clearly. This started with the use of the stone as a weapon, and continued to the domestication of animals, the artificial production of fire by man, and on to the various and admirable inventions of our day, and each of these sprang from the mind of an individual. This becomes clearer as we look at more recent inventions, or if we look at the more significant and decisive inventions of history. We know that everything we see around us in the way of material inventions was produced by the creative energy and ability of individual persons. Fundamentally, all these inventions help raise man higher and higher above the animal world, and they definitely remove him from it. They serve humanity's constant progress in the effort to reach higher levels. Even those things that made life easier, such as a simple trick for the man hunting in the jungle long ago, helps now because it is the basis for brilliant scientific understanding, to make mankind's battle for its present existence easier, and to forge the weapons for the struggles of the future. In its ultimate results, all human thinking and invention serve man's fight for life on this planet. This is true, even if the so-called practical use of an invention or a discovery, or a profound scientific insight into the nature of things may not be immediately obvious. All things together help to raise man more and more above the living creatures around him. They strengthen and consolidate his position so that he expands and becomes the dominant being on Earth in every respect. All inventions result from the work of one person. Intentionally or unintentionally, all these persons are great contributors to mankind. Their work later gave tools to millions, even thousands of millions of human beings, to make their life struggle easier. From the beginning of present material civilization, we see individual persons as inventors who complement one another, and each builds on the work of the one before. The same thing is true when we look at how those inventions are used in new ways. All the processes of production are in themselves inventions and depend on individuals to think them into existence. Even purely theoretical mental work is the exclusive product of an individual person. This is impossible to measure in detail, yet still indispensable for all further material inventions. The masses do not invent, and the majority does not organize or think. No, it is always from the character of the individual man. A community must be organized so that it assists as much as possible the work of these creative forces and makes good use of them in the community. Whether the invention is material or mental, the most valuable part of the invention is the inventor's character. The first and highest concern of a national organization is to place him in a position where he is most useful to the community. It is the organization's purpose to put this very principle into practice. Only in this way is it released from the curse of mechanization so the community may take on life of its own. It must endeavor to set leaders where they manage the masses and consequently to make sure the masses are led by the leaders. The organization must encourage these leaders to emerge from the masses and to remove all barriers that could possibly interfere with their rise. In doing so, it must follow the principle that the blessings of mankind have never come from the masses, but they have come from the creative minds of the individuals. In the real world, these creative minds are the founders and providers of the human race. It is in the best interest of the community to make certain these men have the dominant influence and to assist them in their efforts. Unquestionably, the interests of the community are not satisfied and not served by the rule of the masses, but only by the leadership of those whom nature has equipped with special talents for that purpose. The masses are not experts. The masses do not possess thinking power, and certainly the masses are not divinely gifted. Only individuals have these powers. These great minds are revealed mainly through the hard battle of daily life itself. Many are broken and destroyed in the process, which only proves they are not destined for the ultimate positions of responsibility. At last, only the chosen few remain. This process of selection still goes on today in the areas of education, theory, creative art, and economics. However, in the area of economics particularly, it is already subject to severe handicaps. The same idea rules the civil service state administration, and is also seen in the power of the military defense forces of the nation. In all these areas, the idea of character, its authority over those of lower rank, and its responsibility to those of higher rank still dominates. Today, only the area of politics has completely turned its back on this most natural principle. All of human civilization is the result of the creative activity of individual persons who direct the national community, and especially those who act as leaders. But in politics, the most important principle becomes the strength of the majority. From the top, it trickles down, and it gradually begins to poison all life and ultimately dissolves it. Even the destructive effect of juries' activity, which we can see in other nations, result from its constant effort to undermine the importance of the individual person in those nations hosting their presence. The Jew seeks to replace the power of the individual by the domination of the masses. the organizing principle of Aryan humanity is replaced by the destructive principle of the Jew. The Jew becomes the festering rot of nations and races, and, in a larger sense, the solvent of human culture. Marxism is the pure essence of the Jew's attempts to eliminate the importance of character in every aspect of human life, and replace it with the numerical power of the masses. Its political counterpart is the parliamentary form of government, whose disastrous work we can see going on from the tiny nucleus of the village all the way up to the top of the Reich. Their economic counterpart is the system of trade union movements, which do not serve the true interests of the wage earner, but only the destructive purposes of the international world Jew. The farther our economic system moves away from the influence of the character principle, the more it surrenders itself to the effects of the masses. The national economy should be productive and provide a valuable service to the community, but it will gradually become involved in the inevitable decline as the power of character is replaced by the influence of the masses. All work councils, which were established by the unions, try to gain influence over production instead of protecting the interests of employees, so they serve the same destructive purpose. They harm the total production system and, in turn, harm the individual worker. The members of the nation cannot be satisfied in the long run by fancy theoretical phrases. They will only be satisfied when they receive the goods they need to carry on their daily lives, and through this process, they create a collective conviction among the national community that results in the interests of the community being guarded by the individual and the interests of the individual being upheld by the community. It would not matter if Marxism was able to implement its mass rule theory and happened to take over today's existing economic structure, because it would not prove anything. The reliability or myth of this principle is not determined by its ability to take over and manage a system that already exists. The only valid test is whether or not it has the creative power to build up such a culture based on its own principles. If Marxism were to take over and continue the present economic structure under its own leadership, even if it tried 1,000 times over and was successful in taking control every time, it would prove nothing. Marxism would not be able to use this principle to create a system like the one it takes over today, not one that works at any rate. Marxism has given practical proof of this. Not only has it never succeeded in creating a civilization or even an economic structure, but it has been unable to continue the operation of existing structures according to its principles. When it had the opportunity, it was forced to almost immediately make concessions and return to the ideas of the character principle. It cannot do without these principles, even in its own organization. What most clearly distinguishes the new race-based world concept from the Marxist world concept is the fact that the new race-based world concept recognizes the value of race and the importance of the individual and makes these the pillars of its whole structure. These are the most important factors that carry its world concept. If the National Socialist movement failed to understand the fundamental significance of this essential principle of character, and instead only outwardly patched up the present state or actually considered the mass rule standpoint as its own, it would then be nothing more than another party competing with Marxism on its own principles. It would no longer have a right to call itself a world concept. If the National Socialist program sought to crowd out individuals and replace them with the masses, that would mean National Socialism itself was already eaten away by the poison of Marxism, just as the world of our privileged class political parties are today. The new race-based state can care best for the welfare of its citizens by recognizing the importance of the individual's value in anything and everything relating to the operation and leadership of the community. Maximizing production in every field assures that every individual receives the maximum possible share of that overall output. For that reason, the new race-based state must remove the current obscene political leadership, especially the highest leadership positions, from the grip of majority rule by parliament. This will assure that it will be replaced by the right of the individual, and personal responsibility will be placed there instead. From that, we can draw the following conclusion. The best state constitution and form of state government are those that give the greatest importance and governing influence to the best minds of the national community. Those men who are most capable in the economic world cannot be appointed by someone in a high position. They must fight their own way up the ladder of success. They provide themselves with endless training from the smallest business deal all the way through to the greatest industry, and the challenge of life alone does the testing. Similarly, political brains cannot be suddenly discovered. Geniuses with an extraordinary ability cannot be judged by the same rules as we use for normal humanity. The individual principle must be anchored in the state's organization, from the smallest city council through the head of the government of the entire Reich. There must be no decisions made by a majority, but only decisions made by responsible persons. The word council must be brought back to its original meaning. Every man will have counselors to assist him, but ultimately one man makes the decision. The principle that made the Prussian army a marvelous instrument of the German people must someday be transferred to form the basis of the state. And that principle is this. Every leader will be invested with full authority over those below him, and he will carry full responsibility toward those above. Even then, we will not be able to do without parliaments, but their councillors will only provide counsel, and one man alone will have the responsibility, authority, and the right to command. Parliaments are necessary to identify those minds that will gradually emerge and can later be entrusted with positions of great responsibility. A general picture of how this will work follows. From the village up through the government of the Reich, the new race-based state will not have a representative body that decides anything by majority vote, but only advisory bodies that assist their chosen leader. The leader divides up duties among them, and as needed, they resume absolute responsibility in certain fields, just as the leader or chairman of the particular body has the responsibility on a larger scale. On principle, the new race-based state will not tolerate the practice of asking advice or accepting advice on matters that require special knowledge, for instance, in economic matters, from people who lack that knowledge and cannot possibly understand the matter due to a lack of training and experience. From the beginning, the state must divide its representative bodies into political and occupational chambers. The cooperation between the two will be assured by a special senate that will have authority over them. No vote will ever be taken in either of the chambers or in the senate. They are working institutions, not voting machines. The individual member has an advisory voice, but never a decisive voice. Decisive action belongs solely to the particular chairman who is responsible for the matter being considered. This principle of directly connecting absolute authority with absolute responsibility will gradually cause a group of leaders to emerge. This would be quite unthinkable in our present irresponsible parliament. The nation's state constitution and political structure will then be brought into harmony with the laws of nature to which the cultural and economic fields already owe their greatness. For those who may question the practicality of these principles, I would ask that you not forget the system of parliament which uses democratic majority rule has not always controlled mankind. On the contrary, majority rule is only found in very brief periods of history, and those have always been periods of decline for the people and nations. Such a transformation cannot be produced by purely theoretical measures decreed from the top down, since logically it cannot be limited to the constitution of a state and expected to propagate, but it must penetrate all other legislation and all of civil life. A radical change like this can and will occur only through a movement which is built up in the spirit of these ideas and bears the principles of the coming state within itself. Therefore, the National Socialist movement even today should make itself completely at home with these ideas and put them into practice within its own organization. That way, in the future, it may not only lay down the same guidelines for the state, but may put the perfect body of its own organization at the state's disposal. Chapter 5. World Concept and Organization. I have tried to draw a general picture of the new race-based state. However, it will not be realized by simply understanding what is necessary to construct a state. It is not sufficient to know how a race-based state should look. Much more important is the problem of where to start. We cannot expect the existing political parties, which are mainly landlords of the present state, to take any action themselves toward change or to voluntarily alter their present attitude. This is impossible because they are being directed by Jews. Jews here and Jews there and Jews everywhere. If current events are allowed to develop unhindered, the final result will be the realization of the pan-Jewish prophecy, and the Jew would devour the peoples of the earth and become their master. In contrast to the millions in the German privileged class and workers who amble to their destruction, mainly out of cowardice coupled with apathy and stupidity, the Jew follows his chosen path without hesitation, fully conscious of his future goal. A party led by him can fight for only Jewish interests, and these have nothing in common with the needs of the Aryan. To transform the ideal image of a race-based nationalist state into reality, one must seek new forces that are willing and able to undertake the battle for such an ideal, and one must especially avoid forces related to the current system. And a battle it must be, because the creation of a new race-based state first requires the elimination of the present Jewish concept of a state. It often happens in history that the greatest problem faced is not the formation of a new state of affairs, but in clearing out room for it. Bias and self-interests form a solid front and use every means to prevent the victory of a new idea they find disagreeable and menacing. The champion of such an ideal, with all his positive intentions for it, is forced to fight first in order to wipe out the existing state of affairs. As unpleasant as it may be to the individual followers, a young doctrine of great importance and new significance must use the tool of criticism in all sharpness as its first weapon of assault. It shows little historical insight when the so-called racialists of today keep declaring that they have no intention of indulging in negative criticism, but only in constructive work. This nonsense is as childish and as idiotic as it is truly indicative of the racialist, and it proves how little they know of their own history. Marxism has an aim also, and it is no stranger to constructive work, even if that work is nothing more than the creation of a tyranny of international world finance, by which I mean Jewry. Nevertheless, it began its constructive work by practicing criticism, and has continued for 70 years. And how destructive it was! This corrosive criticism continued until the constant gnawing of the acid undermined the old state and brought it to collapse. Only then did the so-called constructive work of Marxism begin. However, this was actually natural, right and logical. You cannot abolish the current system by simply emphasizing and insisting on a future one. Explaining the necessity for change will not win over followers of the present system, and it certainly will not convert those with an interest in the existing state of affairs. Unfortunately, it may easily happen that both conditions will exist side by side, so that the new world concept becomes a political party, and once that happens, it can never escape from its own limitations. World concepts are intolerant and cannot be satisfied with the role of being a party among others. They arrogantly demand complete and exclusive recognition for themselves and a complete transformation of public life so that it follows their views. A true world concept cannot tolerate any continuing existence of a previous state of affairs side by side with their views. This is equally true of religion. Christianity could never be content with building its own altar. It was driven to destroy pagan altars. The faith could only grow when there was no controversy, and it did grow out of this fanatical intolerance. In fact, intolerance is absolutely indispensable for the growth of any faith. Now, one may object and say such occurrences in world history are related mainly to Jewish ways of thinking, and it is true that this kind of intolerance and fanaticism are common symptoms of Jewish nature. This may be right a thousand times over, however, it is part of all history. And though deeply regrettable, and though we may only grudgingly admit it is part of history, and you can even say this, intolerance is not part of human nature, yet it does not change the fact that this is how the world exists today. The men who want to rescue our German people from the current troubles cannot dwell on how wonderful it would be if things were different, but they must determine how those current conditions can be wiped away. A world concept full of hellish intolerance cannot be shattered except by an idea that is promoted with a similar spirit of intolerance, an idea that is defended by the same intense will, and at the same time is pure and absolutely true in itself. People today may be troubled to discover that the first intellectual terrorism was inflicted by Christianity on the carefree ancient world. However, he will not be able to dispute the fact that since that time, the world has been driven and dominated by Christian forces. Force can only be broken by force, and terrorism can only be broken by terrorism. Only then can a new order be created. Political parties are inclined to compromise. World concepts never compromise. Political parties adjust their views to match those of their adversaries. World concepts proclaim their own infallibility. Political parties almost always start off by planning to achieve total and dictatorial domination. They almost always have some small tendency toward becoming a world concept. But the very limits of their program rob them of the heroism that a world concept demands. This spirit of compromise and placation attracts small and feeble souls who could never champion any crusade. The result is that very soon they are stuck in their own miserable pettiness. This is how they give up the fight for a world concept and resort to using so-called constructive cooperation to secure a place at the feeding trough of the existing regime. Once they have squeezed into their place, they will stay there for as long as possible. This is their whole aim. If they are ever pushed away from the common trough by some brutally inclined feeder, they simply strain and scheme, whether by force or slyness, to push to the front again and feed among the hungry drove. They will use whatever means are necessary to again eat from the cherished fountain of nourishment, even though they sacrifice their most sacred convictions. They are the jackals of politics. No world concept is ever prepared to share its place with another. It can never be ready to help in an existing regime that it condemns, but instead it feels obligated to fight the current state of affairs and the entire world of hostile ideas belonging to that order by every means possible until it achieves the enemy's downfall. This battle of destruction to collapse the adversary, which they instantly recognize as a threat and oppose with united resistance, requires determined warriors. The positive battle to build and establish its own new ideology also requires determined warriors. Therefore, a world concept can lead its ideas to victory only if it unites the most courageous and energetic elements of its age and has the best people in its ranks, solidly shaping them into a vigorous fighting organization. To accomplish this, it is necessary to keep these elements in mind and to pick certain ideas from its world concept that can be wrapped up in brief, precise, slogan-like qualities that make them suitable as a doctrine of faith for a new fellowship of men. While the platform of a strictly political party is a formula for success in the coming election, the program of a world concept is a formula that declares war on an existing order, an existing state of things, and an existing world concept. That does not mean it is necessary for every individual who is fighting for this world concept to have a complete understanding and knowledge of the ultimate ideas and reasoning of the movement's leaders. It is more important that a few fundamentals are made clear to him, and the most essential basic lines stamped permanently in his mind, so that he is absolutely convinced of the need for the victory by his movement and his doctrine.
Tuned in to